dedicated to each and every one of you who appreciate a great glass of wine. You know what I mean?
It's Monday. Let's raise a glass to the beginning of another week. It's time to unscrew, uncork, or saber a bottle, and let's begin exploring the wine glass. Today, we return to Winefabet Street, where the letter of the day is O, and it stands for orange wine. We went right to the source to get the best information on making orange or amber wine. Craig Camp of Troon Vineyards is a trailblazer in the field, and we were lucky enough to sit down with him and pick his brain. While you're listening, please take a moment to scroll down on your phone to subscribe, rate, and review, and tell all your wine-loving friends about Exploring the Wine Glass podcast. Wine. Hey everybody, I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program, Sommelier Service, Champagne Specialist, and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time to swipe, subscribe, rate, and review. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. No, no, no. Hey! Happy Winefabet Monday, everybody. And happy new year. Debbie and I are so happy to be back here in 2021. You know, we did take December off. I think everybody needed a little break in December. But you know what? We are coming back to you with a bang because we have Craig Camp with us of Troon Vineyards. And I mean, both of us have had the opportunity to meet Craig in real life. And you know what? He's an incredible guy. But beyond just being an incredible guy, he is so knowledgeable. And so welcome, Craig. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
He is a trailblazer in the wine industry.
He is. We're really fabulous to be here. Thank you for having me.
And the letter of the day is O. And Debbie and I decided we were going to do orange wine. And there was nobody else. Craig was the first person we reached out to. We knew that was who we wanted to go to. So, Craig, why don't you introduce yourself to the probably few people who don't know who you are?
Well, I've been doing this for a long time. I'm well into my third decade in wine. I originally started an importer and distributorship in Chicago in 1980. And we imported Burgundies and then all the wines, state wines from France and then Italy and then California. We were the first to focus on small estate production wines. So we were, at that time, that was innovative. Now there's all sorts of people doing it. It's well established. Then I sold that company and I spent 3 years in Italy studying winemaking. And then came to the Willamette Valley, where I did a transition of a winery from, it was called Chateau Benoit, to Annemie with new owners. And then followed that up with a decade in Napa Valley at Cornerstone Cellars. And since 2016, taken over the project here at Troon Vineyard in the Applegate Valley in Southern Oregon, where converted the property to biodynamic agriculture and focused on a total replanting project and then focused on the wines of the varieties of Southern France. So very shortly we'll have just over 50 acres planted of biodynamic French varieties. So it's an exciting project. And the first wines, our first biodynamic wines are just coming out now as we speak. You have some of them with you today.
We do. Deb, you want to introduce yourself?
Sure, I'm Debbie Giaquinto. I'm known as the Hudson Valley Wine Goddess. I'm a wine blogger and wine writer. I'm also author of Tapping the Hudson Valley, which is a book on day trips and weekend itineraries visiting the Hudson Valley wine region. And hopefully this spring, after the day I've had today with planning board issues, we will be opening. We had closed Kitchen 330. Our lease was up in Stone Harbor. And we are going to be opening a restaurant called Trio North Wildwood in North Wildwood, New Jersey. Okay. I think that's it in a nutshell.
And I am Lori. My husband and I own Dracena Wines in Paso Robles, California, where we focus in on Cabernet Franc. We are excited to be releasing this vintage, our very first Chenin Blanc. In addition to owning the winery, I am a WSET Level 2 graduate, champagne specialist, Somme de Service. So anyway, we are here today to talk about orange wine. And we are very excited. And so, Deb, do you have your... Yes. So this is what we are getting to drink tonight. Okay. So it is Troon Vineyard, and it is Amphora Amber, and it is an orange wine of Vermentino. And now the second best sound ever, because the first sound is the pop of the cork, but the second best sound is...
pouring the wine. Oh my gosh, it's beautiful.
What it is,
look at that,
it is beautiful. And I've got to say, Vermentino is, I love Vermentino, and it's not very easy to find. So now to find an orange Vermentino, I'm very excited about. So, Craig, I don't know if you have a glass. Do you have a glass with you? There we go. Awesome. So, all together, slancha. And I'm going to start this video.
H-I-J-K-L-M-N-O-P-Q-R-S-T-U-V-W-X-Y-N-Z. Now I know my ABC. Next time, won't you sing with me?
Orange wine. A lot of people don't know about orange wine. They don't understand orange wine. You know, they think maybe it comes from an orange grape.
So does the TTB.
That's not surprising.
How do you get the orange in there? How do you get the orange?
Squeeze them in. We grow bottles on the trees.
So I do think that's a great place to start. Let's do exactly what is an orange wine. What makes a wine an orange wine?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, what you're doing is you're making a white wine just like you do with a red, which is the original way they made them. And, you know, in millennium past, before the advent of destemmers and all these things, is they would just ferment everything together. And the reds and the whites would have been made the same way. And so there's a big difference between those wines and what we do now, because just this advance of viticulture and technology has made orange wines a much more elegant, refined wine than they would have been in the past. Certainly, you know, the country of Georgia is certainly where the tradition mostly comes from, that still lives today, and they still make them. In amphora, like the wine that you have in your glass. So the thing when you're growing for orange wine is, yes, you're using a white grape, but the difference is really made in the vineyard, as it is for most things, because what you're doing is you have to farm like you're making red wine. So you're going to give more skin exposure to get more phenolic ripeness than you would need with a white wine. So obviously in a white wine, you're just pressing in the juice and fermenting the juice. And so you're missing all those elements in the skins. When you're making an orange wine, you're skin fermenting. So you need those phenolics to be ripe, just like they would be in a red. So you really need to select the portion of vineyard you're going to work with and then farm it right from the beginning in a manner very similar to making a red wine. So
Craig, do you leaf pull more?
Yes.
Or do you let them hang longer on the vines?
All of the
all
above.
The above.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So you're definitely pulling more leaves to get, you know, that more skin exposure onto the grapes themselves, and then harvesting later. So, these grapes are harvested a good 10 days after the other, you know, the Vermentino for the white wine would be. So it's a it's a learning process. When I first came here, we had some Riesling, which I'm horrified to say to somebody in New York where they make good Riesling. In our climate, the first year I wanted to so let's make a dry Riesling, and it was awful. I hated it. But what it had is a lot of there's a lot of tannin, a lot of these phenolic flavors. So we had the vines, and I said, well, let's try to make an orange wine, a skin contact, and that was our first try in 2017. And we're really pleased with the results. But what you're seeing now is that accumulated knowledge of those years of development where we understand how to work with the grapes in the vineyard. As a biodynamic winery, obviously there's very little we actually can do in the cellar. There's no additives, there's no enzymes, none of these things. So it's getting the grapes in that proper ripeness. Now, we're very fortunate here in Applegate because of our ripening cycle is quite unique. So we are, we're in between Willamette Valley and Napa, basically, in climate. But we're warmer and drier than the Willamette Valley is, but our growing season is much shorter than Napa. So while we have a lot of warm days like Napa Valley does, because of our altitude, we're at about 1,400 feet, we get very late bud break, and so the season is compacted. So, but we make that up because at the solstice, the longest day of summer, we're getting over 70 minutes more sunshine per day than Napa does. So, and we don't have any fog at this altitude in this climate. It's dry as a bone here. It's like 6% humidity in summer, So like Paso, it's like, so we, but then what happens is in the fall, it reverses where we get very, very short days. So it's still relatively warm, but those really short days bring photosynthesis almost to a crawl. So we can let that fruit hang without the sugars accumulating too much, So it slows sugar accumulation. So we can let that fruit hang without the alcohols getting too high, and then let the phenolics and the skins and those flavors ripen completely without getting an overly alcoholic wine. And so that's, I think that's what you can kind of see in these orange wines, is we're able to get those tannins ripe, but without getting an overt, a higher alcohol level than you would want.
So can you explain to people, because some people might not know what an amphora is?
Yes. Okay. So our orange wine program is, we actually make two orange wines. One is called Kubli Bench Amber. We are on the Kubli Bench. It's a bench above the Applegate River. And then the Amber Amphora. So for the Kubli Bench, we're making that really just exactly like we make our red. So it comes in, it's going into a 1-ton fermenter, it gets punched down once a day, it ferments to dryness in the fermenter, and it's bottled. So it's much, much more fruit forward and ready to go. And that's always a blend. Our Kubli Bench wines are always blends. But the Amber Amphora, we had three amphora for that vintage, and two of them, we literally hand sorted individual berries into two of them. And the other was a whole cluster.
How large are these vessels?
They're about the size of a barrel and a half of wine. Okay. So, they're about, they're probably 4.5 feet high. Mm-hmm. High. Wide, they're heavy. They're forklift material, especially with grapes in them. But the one was whole bunches all together, and so it spent, and we sealed them up, and they spent 10 months like that. We only topped up. Don't have to top up very, very much, because the interesting thing about amphora is, because it's a chemistry thing, because of the ion charges of the clay, it actually creates movement, natural movement inside the container. So it's like a constant, you don't have to punch down. You don't have to pump over. It's a natural process that takes place. The only thing we had to do was occasionally top up. I mean, that's it. So you get this unique oxygenation, and then this character from this natural movement of the juice. And it was fascinating because after 10 months, we took it out, and the berries and the bunches were still intact. It was amazing. You could pick up a bunch of grapes.
Wow.
And it was fully intact. And it, you know, the fermentation had occurred within the berry. So you get almost like a carbonic maceration to start with. And it goes into, of course, alcoholic fermentation in there. But the interesting thing I think about amphora, and we're making actually a white wine now from Vermentino and amphora too, is this textural component that you get. You get this unique, I call it, it's like a smoothness that runs.
It is.
Through the palate from the front to the back.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like most fermentation vessels, you're looking for a certain effect, you know, so for stainless steel, you're looking for this neutral effect, neutral reductive effect. For with oak, you're either with old oak, you're looking for the oxygen and the lees effect. And with new oak, of course, you're looking to add those flavors to the wine. With amphora, I think what you're trying to add is a texture. Is this texture that runs through the palate, because you see that I think in all wines that are fermented in amphora.
So Craig, another big thing that is happening in the wine world is concrete. So how does the clay in the amphora, you know, compare contrast to what you think a concrete would do? Is it similar? Is it?
Well, I think they're all unique. You know, concrete obviously is going to have a much more more temperature control as a major aspect. You know, obviously it takes a long time to change temperature in a concrete tank, but you're going to get that I think a similar oxygen characteristic. I mean, I would like to buy some concrete, but it's like all things, it hasn't hit the budget yet,
right.
But it's on the radar. We're very lucky to have a producer in Oregon making these amphora by hand. So they're really interesting. We'll probably add, now we have five now. We'll probably add a couple a year for the next few years. I mean, that's basically all you can get anyway. So, and build it up for both our white wine and our orange wine programs.
So does an orange wine work the same in terms of a rosé? So like, we know that the skin is what's giving it the colors. And like for our rosé, I'm like OCD about a color of the rosé. Like I'm very particular about what color I want the rosé to be. Are you kind of watching that same aspect? You know, we've seen various colors of orange wines. Are you going for a color, or is it really, are you sitting there tasting it? How do you know when to pull it off of the skins?
Well, in the this wine, the amphora, we had no idea what color it was. It was in amphora, you know, it was basically, it was in the fruit. You know, we had no idea what kind of color it was going to have. The Kubli Bench Amber, you can see the color developing, but it's so different than a red wine. You know, when you're punching down red wine, it's got this beautiful raspberry color that foams up. When you're punching down orange wines, it's this muddy brown, ugly stuff. You know, so it's not the same experience. I mean, for our rosé, I mean, that's just a whole cluster press. So it's whatever skin contact we get in the press, but for these, you're doing an extraction just like you would for red. So it's not controlled in the same way where you're trying to fix color like you would in a red wine, you know.
From the time, you know, you're producing the orange wine, do you know how long it needs to sit on the skins and the seeds, you know, and everything? Well, or is it a, you know, let's see and we'll.
Because you had said it was like 10 months and you pulled it out and the grapes were still there. Why 10 months?
Well, for the Coulee Bench, the more fruit forward one, we just do like for a red and ferment it till it's dry. Look, it's negative brick. So it's just that process the same way. And then it's barreled down and on lees and spends, you know, 4 to 5 months on the lees. For the amphora, that was our first vintage with the amphora. So I guess it's an educated guess, but also, I mean, it's, we did 10 months, frankly, because we were getting ready for harvest then. So we actually pulled this out just before harvest. And so we're pulling out, it's a weird because you're bringing out your press before you picked any fruit. A good dry run for your press, I guess. So, of course we wanted to make another vintage. So we needed to take the fruit out to clear the space to make for the next year. But I'm pretty satisfied with that. I don't know, but I mean, we have no intent to change that this year. Even though we have more really
comfortable. How expensive are they to purchase?
Amphoras?
Yeah.
They're very expensive.
Gotta be, you know, barrels and people.
They last a long time though. I mean, they last longer than barrels do. So,
right. Yeah. So you figure a barrel is $1,200, right? And you get one real use out of it if you want new, and you get two, maybe three. The amphora is huge capital up front, but as long as you take care of it, does it have
last generations potentially?
Okay.
Like it's like concrete, you know. Although it's more breakable than concrete. That's the one thing. It's a great source of paranoia for who's ever driving the forklift.
I'm sure. And then cleaning it, you know, is it cleaned the same way as like a barrel? Or are you using that pressure? It's not. It's not that, big enough that you can get in.
No, we don't want to drive that into. It's a porous material.
Oh, right, right.
So it's just it's a lot of hot water getting down. And you get, you know, that's what harvest interns are for.
Right. They say they're not climbing into an amphora. They're not. You can't.
Yeah, I mean, you don't dump them to empty them. You get down and dig them out.
Right.
You know, like with big pitchers and dump them into a bin and then take it to the press. So it's not it is not an efficient process.
Right. Well, I have to say this is beautiful is not a word for this. I mean, it's amazing. It's stunning. It really is. It has incredible mouthfeel.
I think that's that texture that I was trying to talk about. You get this unique, complete mouthfeel that covers the entire palate.
It's smooth, creamy, but yet wholesome. Mm. It's just
now
everything.
Why Vermentino? Are there certain grape varieties that are better to create an orange wine than other varieties? And what are you looking for in a grape variety to decide, you know, yeah, that's a good orange possibility?
Well, Vermentino's got relatively thick skins for a white variety. And I think that's a key because like with red, you know, a thicker skin variety gives more color, more flavor. You know, it's like comparing Cabernet Sauvignon and Pinot Noir. You know, you've got very delicate Pinot with a thin skin and then the thicker skin Cabernet, which has more depth and power. So it's the same situation. I mean, if you taste Vermentino, it has kind of this little, a white wine made from Vermentino. It'll have this little bitterness that runs through it, which is part of the characteristic of Vermentino. And that comes from those skins, even a brief skin contact on the press, you're going to extract some of that. So for me, it was ideal for making orange wine. We've also had really good results with Viognier.
Right.
We're really glad excited about Viognier. Again, a thicker skinned variety. And it just produces this range of really complex flavors. So you're looking for that. You want something that's not just, that actually has some depth to the skins to add to the wine. Otherwise, you just end up with kind of a thin, bitter wine, I think.
Okay. And then I actually have, I got a question from Michael. He is a true red wine lover. So orange wines are, I guess, a little bit out there of his comfort zone for him. What can you tell him, you know, as a true red lover, why he should give the orange wine? He wants to know why he gives an orange wine a try.
From my perspective, I like different wines, different things. But I think the interesting thing about orange wine is because it has some of the same tannins and structure as you get in a red, that you can serve it with many of the same dishes. It's a really incredibly versatile wine. You could have it with almost anything. But if it's a hot day and you're grilling outside having some steaks, and
that's
maybe
exactly what he's doing.
a little over the edge for a big red, that an orange wine that you would serve cooler, but would still give you structure is a really interesting option, I think.
I find, and this is a true testament to it, it is not a light wine. It is a full-bodied wine. It is coating your mouth, and it is, you know, it's not one of those acid bombs. It's, you know, you're not drinking a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc here. You're not getting, it is, in my opinion, a white wine for a red wine lover, because it is full bodied.
It is smooth and silky. Mm. I mean, I took one sip of this and I was just like, wowed.
Now, I will say that there have been in my past some orange wines that go on that funky side. And I don't know if that is old. I don't want to say old school, because orange wine is old school. But like, you know, a different version of a winemaker's thought process of it. This is not funky. This doesn't have that what am I drinking? This is full bodied, just a exceptional wine made. It is not like, I've had some orange wines that I'm like, all right, this might be technically not sound wine. This is 100% sound wine. This is beautiful, and it will stand up.
Deal.
Yeah, it will stand up to your meals, Michael. It will stand up to what you are typically serving on your barbecue table and your other meals.
Yeah, I mean, these certainly qualify with what would quote unquote be called natural wines, which is an unfortunate name, but that's what we've got. So you're talking, these are extreme, you know, it's everything at Troon is all native yeasts. There's no additives of any kind. The only additive we add is a very low dose of sulfur prior to bottling. So these are going to be, for the geeks in the crowd, about 30 parts per million or less. So very, very low. And the problem, I think, with natural wine is, first of all, if you're going to do minimalist winemaking, you need pristine fruit. You can't have fruit that has a lot of issues, you know, rot and molds and things like that. So we have an ideal climate for that, you know, with a very low humidity. We have very low disease pressures. And so we almost don't really have to sort our fruit, because we just don't have those issues. It's not a problem for us. The second is you have to have just spotless. You have meticulous hygiene in the winery. So I find that a lot of natural, so-called natural wines, or, you know, get into that funky thing, they're just spalted. To me, it's important to make natural wine, but I want to make clean, naturally, you know, wines without faults. You know, that's it's just the key. And to do that, you just have to really work at it, and you have to, you know, really watch the details, watch your hygiene, make sure everything is spotless, and have really high quality fruit.
So I have a question. You're talking about pristine fruit. And so for our Chenin Blanc, we are purposely looking for bunches that some are underripe, some are perfect ripe, some are overripe. And that to us is what is pristine fruit, because that's what gives that complexity in the Chenin.
I agree.
Is that how you're also looking for your fruit in a Vermentino orange wine? Like,
yeah, I think that's why it's important not to oversort. You eliminate. I when I was in Napa for a couple of vintages, I got to work with an optical sorter, and the first time you see it, it's like amazing. You're like, oh, this is the most wonderful thing ever, because all that comes out are these perfect little blueberries of Cabernet Sauvignon. You know, but what I found it did is it made the wine in a monotone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you need that range of ripeness. That's for sure. I don't think you need, I mean, with Chenin, you may want a little, I don't know what style you're making, you know, maybe you want a little noble rot in there.
No, we don't want noble rot.
So whatever, but for what we're doing, we just don't want any of those things, but we want, so it's a natural, yes. I mean, that's a really great point, is that you want that range of ripeness. So we're not going through and picking out every other bunch.
And now a word from our sponsor. Looking to be in the know about Dracena wines? Want to be the first to know about our new releases and special offers? All you need to do is sign up for our newsletter. There is no commitment necessary, and I promise you we won't spam your mailbox with loads of messages. Need another reason to sign up? Quite possibly the best reason? You'll immediately get a discount code for 10% off your first purchase and be privy to newsletter-only discounts. Let Dracena Wines turn your moments into great memories. Visit our website, www.dracenawines.com, or use the link in show notes to sign up. It will take you less than a minute, but the rewards will last a lifetime.
So Karen has a question here, and she read on the Kublai Bench Amber label that it's 74% Riesling. Would that provide the fruit forwardness in that flavor?
I think it's the Viognier, actually, that really does it in that wine. The Riesling is really quite structured. It's surprising when you do it for the first time. That's another thicker skin variety, and that is actually, we're picking that at the same time we're picking our last red varieties. This comes down to this time, and so it's got a lot of structure to it, a lot of depth. But I think the Viognier really adds this charm and floral aspect to it that I think is really, really, really attractive.
So going back to this wine, there's so much information on this label. So on the back, it has biodynamic certified winery. So can you explain, because from my understanding, that is a lot of regulation, certification, paperwork to get that regulation. So can you just kind of explain a little bit about what is required to be able to put that on your label?
Okay, so biodynamics, first of all, it's a whole farm concept. You're treating, the idea is to treat the farm as one organism. So we're looking to through a range of biodiversity is a real important aspect to that. So we have now we've added, we've just planted over 200 apple trees, 20 varieties of apple cider, you know, French apple ciders, apples. So we'll be making a cider. We do a, we're adding, you know, sheep and chickens, and we're producing over 220 tons a year of biodynamic compost right on the property. Our next door neighbor is a organic dairy, which is a great asset.
Yeah.
Great asset. And, you know, we've got, now we're doing a two acre vegetable garden. I'm working a 4 acre plot of grains to work with a local brewer to make beer. So it's the idea is to have this whole range of interactions that create a natural environment. And it's really focusing, you're focusing on a, I call it, it's like a probiotic, you know, program. Everybody's into probiotics now. You go to the drugstore and buy your probiotics. What we're doing is creating probiotics for the plants to build up that natural system in the soil, so they can take nutrition from the soil naturally without the addition of any other nutrients and things like that. So, you know, I always think, you know, people, we're really arrogant. We think we know more about growing grapes than grapevines, and that's not true. What we have to do is let the grapevine do its job and help it along, not try to tell it what to do. So that's really biodynamics, is you're creating this natural system. And that's Demeter is the name of the organization that controls biodynamics. So you have to go through a certification process, you know, where lots of paperwork, as you mentioned, and on-site inspections, and you know, tracking through, and so that you're following all these pillars. So we're also organic certified, which is just part of, I mean, if you're biodynamic, you have to be organic. So it's, you know, you might as well do it anyway. But now we're also pursuing this new certification, which I find really interesting, called regenerative organic.
Oh.
Which I think is kind of a combination of biodynamics and organics. But organic certification, you know, it's based, they're basically telling you what not to do. Don't do this, don't do that, don't put this on and everything. Where biodynamics is a kind of this more proactive, you know, build your soils, regenerate. And then this new certification also builds in a social welfare aspect for your agricultural workers and things like that. So I just think it's important to make that commitment. It's a wonderful goal for the team to have, to achieve these certifications. I think it brings you together as a team to think in different ways. And we've always, you know, you always talk about biodynamics with the soil and the plants, but I really feel that one of the biggest aspects of biodynamics is the change it makes in the culture of your organization and the way people think. It changes the way they work with each other and about it. So yes, it's a big deal, but I think it's important. And I think we decided to do the certifications because I think the consumer needs to know. I mean, that's just a way for them to ascertain that the product they're buying is in alignment with what their values are.
When you began at Troon, they were not biodynamic certified.
No.
Right. So that was basically your thing. So I always, it's almost like you can drive through vineyards and you can see which ones are.
Oh, for sure.
You know? Yeah. So how was it like living, you know, it's one thing, you know, when you see a picture and you see a picture, but like you're living it day to day. How did it feel to see all your hard work? Because it is hard work. To be hands off is hard work. To see the progression and to see the soils come to life and the biodiversity that is growing within those soils.
It's incredibly rewarding. I mean, you go from, when I came here, it looked like the vines were planted in concrete. You know, it's just this, but for decades of you know, industrial agriculture had really killed everything, and there were no animals on the property, no bees, no birds, you know. But now it's the property is filled with life, and I think that's the exciting part. I mean, there's bees everywhere. There's worms. There's snakes and bats.
Created the property.
Yeah, no, it's a totally. I mean, this is where regenerative is such an important word, and it is perhaps the most important word of all, because you to make a successful farm, you have to put back more than you take out. It's really that simple, and you can't use chemicals to do that, because a plant has a natural system to take, you know, to get nutrition from the soil, and if you take that system away from the plant, it weakens that plant, and then the plant becomes susceptible to all sorts of other diseases. And that's what I saw here. We had all sorts of trunk diseases and things like that that have really, we've really been able to knock them back and make a difference in the health of the vine. I mean, see it, but you can taste it and see it in the fruit and even in the chemistry. A real interesting aspect is we look at our fermenter chemistries now, and the change is just staggering, really, as to how much healthier the fruit is. So it's really exciting process for us. But that's the ultimately rewarding thing, is to see the farm come back to life and a natural system reestablish itself. And then and then of course you make better wine, which was the whole point to begin with.
You know, that's the thought process of the vine itself being healthier to resist their immune system is better if they're healthy. You're honestly the first person I've heard, and all the people we've talked to about biodiversity and, you know, regenerative, you're the first person who has actually said, you know, mentioned it in that realm, you know, if you're a healthier person, you can fight off, you know, different diseases. If you're a healthier vine, they're going to be able to fight off the diseases that are, you know, impeding on other vines.
Mm-hmm. It works exactly the same way. And the plant, you know, has very few options as for how to defend itself. So if you take any of them away, there's no way that you can make up that difference. And eventually you lose the plant. I mean, this is why you see a lot of, in California, for instance, you'll see a lot of vineyards that after 20, 25 years, they're taking them out. It's because they've weakened those vines so much with the way they're farming them. That they can't, you know, you don't see those 75 year old vineyards like you do in Europe.
Right.
Very often.
Right. Wow. It is amazing. You know, I mean, you always talk about, you know, it's the circle of life. It's all of that. But you can see it. You can see it in a vineyard. Like when you drive by, you can literally go, nope, nope, yap, you know, to which ones are. And,
No. I mean, if the vineyard's not messy, it's not natural. Yeah. If there's nothing growing in it but vines, that's not natural, you know. Right. So, I mean, if you there should be things growing in the vineyard. It should look a little messy.
Should be life.
Yes.
Yeah, full of life. Yeah.
So, do you guys have a shepherd?
Sarah Thompson, our assistant winemaker, is our shepherd. Okay. She runs Sarah runs our biodiversity program, so that's her. She chases the sheep and chickens.
awesome. Now on your label, you also have vegan friendly. So is that regulated?
I mean, we registered with Barnivore, which is, you know, you have to go through a process. It's not something, there's no formal process like there is with biodynamics or something. There should be, but I never really thought about that before until somebody asked me if the wines were vegan, and I had to think about it for a second. I said, yeah. So I guess so. And then over the years, it kind of became a thing. And we are in Oregon, so we felt communicating that we were not using you know, animal byproducts in the production of the wine, which is basically fining.
Fining, I mean, right.
But which is no big deal since we don't fine. It's not
an issue. No, okay, you don't fine, and that's why there is a bit, you know, it's a little bit cloudy.
Particularly that one, yeah. I mean the other wines won't, you don't see that. I mean
people shouldn't be put off by that.
That's part of the orange wine. It's just that's a really minimally handled wine. So it's going to have those that characteristics to it. I mean, they're all unfiltered, you know.
So Craig, what would you pair with this particular wine?
Well, you know, I love the orange wines like this as aperitif. I think they're just fantastic, you know, when you come home as a first glass. But anytime you're having a meal with a lot of different dishes, which is really typical. Remember when we used to go out and everybody would order something different. But, you know, a tapas type situation with a lot of different types of food. I think they are just the ultimate wine for that kind of meal.
Now I know this is a corny pairing, and we know that oranges are not squeezed into here, but orange chicken and this wine,
there you go.
Yeah, I taste a little bit of orange, you know. Yeah. no pun intended in this wine.
Yeah, I think Asian foods for sure. It's and sushi, they go great with sushi.
I like the orange wine, or you know, the orange chicken, sesame chicken, all of those Asian dishes I think would go great. I'm thinking, you know, like a pasta dish with a little chicken that is, you know, that has a little, you know, seasoning on it, like Italian seasoning on it, would be wonderful. And I in terms of pairing, I'm finding it difficult to think of something that it really would be off with.
It's true.
You know, yeah. But absolutely. But so Craig, how much is this in retail?
So that is $35. And I think we made all of 90 cases.
Wow. You sell it outside the tasting room?
Yes, it is distributed in several states. Obviously, not a lot of states. I mean, our wines, you're going to tend to find them in, you know, the kind of natural wine type markets and you know, wine shops and wine bars that specialize in that, because we are a small production winery. And we do sell a lot of wine in Oregon, or thank goodness Oregonians are very loyal. We've appreciated them that in the last year, for sure, but we are sold in over a dozen other states. So,
so what actually is your is Troon's case production on average?
Right now, we're about 5,000 cases.
Oh, okay.
And we're in this replanting program, and it'll go up to about 9,000 over the next 4 or 5 years.
And what do you see? I mean, and it may be nothing, but what do you see as Troon's like flagship? What would, you know, if somebody's like, oh, well, you know, Troon Vineyards, what's their flagship?
It's hard to say. I think Syrah is so ideal for this climate and these soil types. We've put a lot of, Syrah, Grenache, Mourvèdre, we've planted an extensive range of clones. And instead of putting them all in one block, we've spread them out. So there's a little block over here and a block over, so they're in different soil types. We did a lot of soil research, you know, really broke down the site by soil types, and then broke up blocks within varieties and clones so that we'll be able to put these blends together. So I think that the you know, Rhone style blends are going to be the thing that we're known for.
Signature.
And how many acres under vine do you have about?
So it's a 100-acre property. We'll have almost 55 acres of vines. Okay. And they're obviously not all in production yet, but then we'll have eventually three over 300 apple trees and the gardens.
Yeah, you had mentioned cider, so you plan on producing the line of cider.
Debbie, I don't know if you noticed, Debbie and I, we both perked up when we heard cider.
Cider is something I need to personally explore more, but.
New York, hey.
Cider heaven. I have personally explored cider a lot. I have personally explored cider a lot, and I will continue to explore cider. I guess you're not producing that yet, but is there a relationship to how you produce cider versus, you know, producing wine? Two completely different concepts?
Well, I mean, it'll be in the same, I mean, it'll be biodynamic cider. It'll be biodynamic certified cider. So it's an all natural product. Well, the trees take a few years before we get apples. So.
Right. So actually, that's a good question. That's, that was popping in my head. So vines, you figure, people are picking fruit a bit early on some vines, but you figure 5 years as an average before you're, all right, maybe I'll take some fruit. What about apple trees?
About the same. Is it about 5 years?
Okay. Yeah.
Before you get to a commercial one, I mean, like we've got some vines that'll be 3 years old this year. We'll probably get a little rosé fruit off of them or something like that. But obviously, it's a slow motion business.
Yeah, yeah. You're not jumping in and making you're really never jumping in and making millions, but you're really not jumping in and making a quick million.
There's not a lot of immediate gratification.
No. So I'm going to go back. I'm sorry. I'm going to go back to orange wine. This is also known as an amber wine, right? I mean, in the old world, it was called an amber wine. We joke about putting the oranges in there and all of that. But do you think that it being called an orange wine is part of why some people are not so willing to open their thoughts to it?
That's a good question. I mean, we went to amber because like everything else, we have white wines and red wines and rosé, a pink wine. Mm-hmm. So we thought we would go with the color amber. Also, as you mentioned, it's a traditional name, certainly, in Georgia and things like that. There was an excellent book on orange wines put out a year or two ago called Amber Revolution. Mm-hmm. I apologize. I can't remember the author's name right now, but very good book. And so we felt it just fit into that slot for us. We've been surprised by the general acceptance of it in our tasting rooms. It's extremely popular. I mean, I thought it would, it'd be, the wine bars and things like that where they knew these types of wines already would be interested in it right away. But we've done some really interesting things. We made a Piquette, a sparkling Piquette, from pumice. And it's very unusual, it has this sort of fruity and sparkly and, really charming. And that was a tremendous hit in the tasting room. Nobody ever heard of it before. So I guess that's the advantage of being a niche winery, which we definitely are, is I don't need to worry about broad market considerations. And we can just connect to the consumers that are interested in what we're doing. So, I mean, there's so many people that are doing it now. I mean, if you go to Portland and San Francisco, it's totally common to see an orange wine section on a wine list now. And that wasn't like that just a few years ago. So now I think it's really starting to hit the mainstream. Mainstream. Some other stream, but not the mainstream. But
what is the demographics that are accepting it, do you think? Do you think it's more millennials, Gen Xers, baby boomers?
I think it's pretty broad now. I think it's more people that are in, I think the interest in biodynamics and organics will tend more towards a total lifestyle type of choice. Okay. People going out of their way to find cleaner, healthier foods and things like that. I think there's also, certainly I think in younger consumers that there's more awareness of what may or may not be in something. And I think there's a general interest in younger consumers. I'm not sure where that alphabet falls in the X or Y or whatever, but that are open to it. So, I mean, you know, you go into into some cities and where, especially where they have, you know, these smaller wine shops and things that focus on these types of wines, and they sell a pretty broad range of consumer. I'm pretty impressed, but it's definitely the more adventurous consumer. I mean, we're not going to go into the main grocery store distribution or anything.
Okay.
Although I guess some of the bigger companies are actually doing that now. So
with an orange wine?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I was like, I can't imagine going down to my local Save Mart or Vons and, you know, well, although I will say probably, and this is horrible for me to say, but if I'm finding an orange wine in Save Mart or Vons, I'm probably going to turn the other way. Guessing it's not being made in the same care and quality that this wine is being made in.
I think that's a fair bet.
But anyway, I'm just kind of scrolling through the chat. If we have any, we're almost at our hour. So yeah. I don't know if we have any. Time flies when you're talking orange.
I know.
I don't know if anybody in the chat has any other questions. But, or Deb, do you have any final questions?
Craig, this is a home run.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's a grand slam.
Many orange wines, but this really... really has hit me like home run.
Yeah, I think it's really representative of our style of winemaking, that you can make interesting natural wines that are clean, commercially made, you know, viable wines. They don't have to be weird.
Right.
And when you say clean, I mean the whole experience with the wine is clean.
Yeah.
And the mouthfeel is just beautiful and elegant and... it's incredible.
It really is. And, you know, the more you smell it, the more aromas you get. And I put it in the fridge and I pulled it out about a half an hour before. So I had it in for like 40 minutes and pulled it out a half an hour before. And I have to honestly say, I made a mistake. It was actually too chilly and it was still beautiful. It was still beautiful when we started this. But now it's warmed up, and the aromas have just gone through. There is orange, mandarin kind of, but there's an almond. You know, I forget what the fancy word is for the almond, but it is truly beautiful. So I'm going to tell anybody who purchases this wine and drink it, you're ruining it if it's cold. Yeah.
I think, you know, just like you'd serve a Beaujolais or something like that. Just cool.
Mm-hmm.
So, Craig, Karen wants to know, can Craig elaborate on his offer to buy tours?
I guess maybe on your website. Do you offer tours on your website?
We have some VRBO vacation rentals on the website that are on the vineyard. And so I'm not sure.
I don't know what she means, but maybe if I put my glasses.
You can do tours if you come to the winery. You can make an appointment for a tour, yeah.
And actually, Craig, I was going to ask that now. So, like, I mean, we all are tired of talking about COVID, but how can people visit you currently? And how has that changed so that when we finally get out of this, how can they visit you? What can they expect?
Well, currently we can't do indoor tasting. We can only do outdoor tasting, which being in the mountains of Southern Oregon can be not so great some days. we have a pretty mild climate, but, you know, it's a West Coast climate. And in the summer, everybody wants to sit outside anyway, so it's not the summer. Summer was not a problem for us. Okay. We do have, you know, we have visitors all the time. It's just outdoors.
Okay. I will get out there to visit you.
You have to. No.
I am going to. My customer at the restaurant, Rhonda, she's coming out next week. I'm telling her she's got to bring me home another bottle of this.
Is she coming to the winery?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Her father lives down the road. And yeah.
Oh, cool.
So, Craig, as we wrap it up, if you can just tell everybody social media-wise where they can find you. And I'm just seeing Karen said that you wrote, does anyone want to buy tours of Troon Vineyards?
That's what I just said.
So I think it was probably a typo.
Could be.
I think it was a typo. But so do you actually in normal times, do you offer walking tours of the vineyard and educational
yes.
tours?
Yeah. In the summer when the weather is, right now it'd be too muddy to go out unless you bring your hip
Wellers.
Boots. You
know.
But in the summer we have a range of tours we do and biodynamic education and, vineyard tours in general. Cellar tours, the whole thing. Then those are usually posted up on the website in April.
Okay.
So tell everybody where they can find you, Troon Vineyards, and your blog, because your blog is
incredible.
Awesome.
Yes.
Thank you. Well, you can find troonvineyard.com. I think you'll find a lot of information there on the winery, and you can find me at Twitter at Craig Camp and at craigcamp.com for my blog and various other musings. And I'm on social media as Craig Camp everywhere. So it's easy spelling. So,
well, thank you so much, Craig, for
thank you.
Joining us and educating us. And it's just been wonderful. And I can't wait for the day where I can see you in person and hug
yes.
you.
Yes, yeah, that's what we're all waiting for. Goodness gracious.
2021.
Yeah.
Hope so.
So thank you very much, Craig. Thank you for everybody who joined in the chat and the conversation. And Deb, next month we have?
Oh, Petite Syrah.
We are doing Petite Syrah from Susan Valley. We will be looking forward to that. So thank you.
And you can register for that at wineforbetstreet.com. Pull down, register for the webinar, and click Petite Syrah.
Awesome. So thank you again, Craig. This wine is incredible. And Debbie and myself keep adding where we're going to go together. So we are here.
Chin-chin.
Slancha. Thank you.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoytbud. Of course, you can always email me at exploringtheWineGlass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe to help others find me more easily. And most importantly, tell your wine-loving friends, because if you like the podcast, they will too. Music is Wine by Kevens. Until next week, Slancha. You are so special, even in the Bible.